The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, is promising a fundamental shift in the immigration system to cut the number of people coming to the UK to work, including an end to the recruitment of care workers from overseas. She's setting out plans tomorrow to tighten rules on visas. Ms Cooper told Sunday with Laura Koonsberg she wouldn't set a target for reducing immigration, but she said changes to rules for care workers and lower-skilled staff would quickly cut the numbers.
Those changes will come in the course of this year, and those changes together will lead to, we expect to lead to a reduction of up to 50,000 fewer lower skilled visas over the course of the next year. And we'll set out other measures as well, but we're going to do this in a step-by-step managed approach.
The Conservatives say the 50,000 figure is not enough and tougher measures are needed. Russia and Ukraine are publicly at odds over whether a ceasefire or peace talk should happen first. Overnight, Vladimir Putin proposed direct talks in Istanbul on Thursday, but did not respond to calls by European leaders for a 30-day ceasefire. A key aide to Ukraine's President Zelensky said that a ceasefire must happen before talks take place, but Russia's foreign ministry has said the talks must come first. Pope Leo's used his first Sunday message to call for an end to wars around the world. Speaking to crowds gathered in St Peter's Square, the Pope called for an authentic and lasting peace in Ukraine. He also said there should be a ceasefire in Gaza, in addition to the release of hostages and the delivery of humanitarian aid. Nearly 300 properties are without power after a fire broke out at a substation in the centre of Exeter. Emergency services arrived at the scene at 6 o'clock this morning and are still tackling the blaze. Passengers arriving and departing from London Stansted have been warned to expect delays after the airport was hit by an IT issue. The glitch has been resolved, but the airport says some flights will still be disrupted. The annual BAFTA TV Awards will take place this evening at a ceremony in London. The show's Baby Reindeer, Mr Bates versus the Post Office, The Traitors and Gavin and Stacey all have multiple nominations. And the weather, clear skies and sunshine for most this afternoon, but there will be occasional heavy showers in the southwest of England and Wales and spells of rain in northern parts of Scotland. Highs of 19 in Belfast and Edinburgh, 23 in Cardiff and 25 in London. BBC News at 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The theatre director, Emma Rice, is renowned for her bold stagings of much-loved films and books, including Brief Encounter, Wuthering Heights and The Red Shoes. For 20 years, she worked as an actor, director and eventually artistic director of Knee-High, an international touring company based in Cornwall, known for its energetic productions with an inventive use of music and puppetry. In 2016, Emma became artistic director of Shakespeare's Globe, the reconstructed Elizabethan theatre on the south bank of the Thames, although her tenure there ended after just 2 years following disagreements with the board. She has since founded her own touring theatre company, Wise Children, whose recent productions include The Buddha of Suburbia and Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest. Well, we've got Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, Mozart, but I think you're going to start with God, i.e. Bach.
I am going to start with Bach, yes. This is what my dad would pass on to me and my sister. He had a sort of amazing moment as a student, which he described to us throughout our lives, but also at the very end of his own life, he was still remembering a moment where, as an ordinary student from Bristol, he heard this piece of music being played in a church and went in and listened to it and never forgot the exquisite beauty of this. He was always a music lover. Our lives were filled with music, but this was the one that he returned to again and again and again. And we played at his funeral. And there was a funny thing when he died, because he planned his Desert Island Discs his entire life. He was constantly saying, I've changed my choice. But he also planned his funeral all his life. And then when he died, I said, where's his funeral plan? And we couldn't find it. So we did it from memory and from talking to him at the end, and we got it right. But this was always on the list. It was absolutely the piece that touched his heart and ours. It's like an open beating heart, isn't it? The way it dances on all of those beautiful instruments.
There's not just the lyrical beauty of it, but there's a great sense of humour too. It's a jocoso, the way one instrument will go ba-ba-ba and the other will go ba-ba-ba. And he's almost playing with the voices, isn't he?
It's so playful, witty. It's hard not to smile when you listen to it. It's got such a joyful, cheeky upbeat.
Was smiling quite an integral part of your childhood in Nottinghamshire?
I had a phenomenally happy childhood. Beautiful parents, loving parents, grateful parents. Both my mum and dad were the first people in their generation to go to university and revelled in the doors that opened for them, revelled in music and in culture and in art. Neither of them were artists. My dad was a teacher and my mum was a social worker. But we were taken to the theatre, we were taken to the concert hall with great enthusiasm. My dad was such a man full of enthusiasms and love, and it was completely intoxicating. You couldn't help but catch his enthusiasm from him.
How important do you think that access to the arts at a very young age is?
For me, life-changing, vital. And I think it wasn't just the art I was exposed to. It was the excitement I was exposed to. I remember my mum and dad looking at the brochures for Nottingham Playhouse, it was, that would come through, and then deciding which plays we might go and see. And then on that night, we would get dressed up. It would be a very exciting family ritual. And when we went to see concerts, we would go right up to the very top of the gods and be told to be quiet and listen, and then watch my dad have these sort of near religious experiences with the music. So not only was I exposed to art, but I was exposed to the thrill and the wonder of art and the gratitude of being able to live that life.
Now, Jake Thackeray next. I think this was a family favourite. It's very extraordinary the way Jake Thackeray pops up quite often on
Does
this programme.
He was really a firm favourite on car journeys for us. Mm. My dad would make us these mixtapes, Kate and Emma's mixtapes, me and my sister, and he would fill it with lots of different music, and he'd sneak in more serious stuff so that we would not only be exposed to fun things like Mud or The Sweet, he loved a bit of glam rock, but also classical music and folk music. And Jake Thackeray would turn up again and again, and this particular song, To Do With You, he was such a romantic. He loved my mum every day in heart and in action and told her so, I think possibly to her great annoyance. And that was a huge colour in our lives, to watch this very demonstrative love from my dad towards my mum, who would often say, "Be quiet, Chris, don't be silly." But this he loved because it was a song about married love, and it was a song about how difficult love can be and how hard it has to be. But it's really, really about being totally invested in another human being. And of course, I was party to that as well. He was totally invested in me and my sister and my mum. And I mean, what a gift. What an absolute gift.
Such an idiosyncratic voice, but also wonderful lyrics.
I never tire of the lyrics. They make me cry for all the reasons that I've just described. But how clever, how human, how tender, how witty. It's absolutely beautiful.
There may be better cooking, better looking women, better slung and better at buns than you. And if I were a man for simple things like flawless skin and bigger dinners, my dearest, I might have no more to do with you. But you know well enough that I am much more choosy. I want day to day to find myself with you. With the cheek to cheek, the tooth and claw, the milk and honey and the bread and water, dearest, I want everything to do with you. A marriage is supposed to go like happy ever after clockwork, marking time with a regular chime of I love you. But there are days enough when the love is racked and pinioned, which nobody else knows better than we two do. There may be better at and better bedtime women, erudite wives at night than you. And if I were the simple sort of bloke for Kierkegaard and Kant and Coco, dearest, I would have no more to do with you. But there's no such dependable stupendous woman, up to the scratch, no match, not a patch on you. And eye to eye, or toe to toe, kiss for kiss, and blow for blow, my dearest, I want everything to do with you. A marriage is supposed to go like happy ever after clockwork, marking time with a regular chime of I love you too. But there are days enough when the love keeps coming and coming, which nobody else knows better than we two do. Taste in men than you've got, dearest, I shall have to just make do with you. There's no such one caress and leave me breathless, woman, no such ten godsend friend as you. And not now and then, nor if and whether, but time and again, forever and ever, my dearest, I want everything to do. No such one caress and leave me, breathless woman. No such tender godsend friend as you. And not now and then, nor if and whether, but time and again, forever and ever, my dearest, I want everything to do with you.
Be the most romantic song ever written.
And he uses his voice like a percussion instrument, doesn't he? Boop, boop,
boop. Yeah, I know, and the way he does
bounces off himself.
He bounces and then just puts in those tiny high notes at the end. And the beautiful guitar playing. Of course, my dad was a self-trained jazz musician. Jazz was his first love. So a song like that with Jake Thackeray, the way that the guitar blends with the voice, is heaven, isn't it?
How did you get on at secondary school, Emma Rice?
Gosh, I don't think anybody's ever asked me that. Terribly. I mean, I wasn't academic. Still not. It was a very rough school. I think I spent most of my schooling just avoiding getting any attention. I kept my head down. I think I daydreamed a lot. I think I had quite a good brain to memorise things, which meant I could tend to get by in exams, which drove my mum and dad mad because I would do absolutely no work and then do OK at the end. But I felt adrift at school, and I can remember just waiting. I can remember thinking, this time will pass and I will be able to be myself. So I went to sixth form college to read drama, dyed my hair blue, put on lots of black eye makeup, became a goth, and my life sort of started there. I mean, I had a beautiful home life, but school life I dreamt my way through.
You experienced grief, didn't you, with one of your friends?
I did, yes. My dear friend Becca, we were young to know what friendship was, really. She lived three doors down from me, and we would go to ballet classes together, and we both absolutely loved nothing more than dressing up and making up dances. So that was the basis of our friendship, really, was various ways to show off. And she got leukemia. And it was the 1970s, and it tore our community and family apart, but with so little conversation, that it affected me for a very, very long time. I think it would have done with conversation as well. But I look back and I think so much of that grief and confusion was processed at night in the loneliness of the dark. And also, you know, because of this bubble that we discussed of great joy that my dad particularly delivered, it felt very hard to bring the language of grief into that family. So it was a very private grief, and probably less to this day, although it does get easier.
It probably influenced you in the theatre, and I think the theatre became something of an escape at that time too.
I'm certain that's true. I always was drawn to the theatre. I think there's an immediacy to theatre which suits me. Clearly it suited me. It's where I've spent my life. But there's a great relief about that. It's very immediate. Something has to be done. Somebody has to be entertained. A song has to be sung. A dance has to be expressed. And I think that the need to be in the moment in theatre is a great relief if you are experiencing grief or confusion. But also telling stories is so therapeutic. It's so therapeutic. You can go to dark places. You can channel what you feel. And nobody notices because it's your job. It's private and public at the same time.
What subjects were you concentrating on in further education?
So it was a drama course, and I did two A-levels, English literature and stage decor and design. But mostly, we had this derelict old drama shed, and we made a play every week. One of us would write it, one of us would light it, we'd do the sound, some of us would act, and we'd rotate every week, and we lived for it. And it wasn't part of the academic course at all, but that sense of putting on a show, I mean, there is nothing like it. It is my drug of choice.
Well, we'll come on to how that manifested itself in later life, but first, Mozart Horn Concerto, Larghetto.
Well, we have to go back a step for this, because my dad's greatest wish would have been for me and my sister to have become musicians. And in fact, my sister nearly did. She studied the bassoon at music college. Very talented, brilliant musician. I was less talented and certainly less dedicated, but my instrument of choice was the French horn. I think I've always had a sort of visual eye, and I loved its roundness. I found it deliciously funny that I put my hand up its bell, which is probably not good reasons to choose one of the most difficult instruments on the planet to play. But I persevered. I got to grade six. But of course, all I want is results in life. I have very little interest in process. And one of the things that was bought for me, they were called Music Minus One. They were vinyl records of an orchestra playing, but without the soloist. And I had the Mozart Horn Concerto. And obviously, it was my greatest dream that I would be able to perform this whole concerto. In truth, I never managed the first.
You didn't get on to it.
I did, but very badly and not fast enough. But I could manage the second movement.
Thank you.
Well, it certainly did not sound like that in my sitting room at home as I tried to get through it. Isn't it gorgeous?
I hope you didn't use too much hand and the bell consordine in that movement. Although there was a moment where he used that metallic sound.
Yes.
And that is done by stopping it.
A stop, yeah, a hand stop, I think.
The Larghetto from Mozart's Horn Concerto No. 3 in E-flat major, performed by Alec Frank Gemmell, and the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas McGeegan. I can't help wondering, Emma Rice, whether your exposure to music has been helpful to you in the theatre. I'm thinking of that use of space and timing.
I cannot make theatre without music. And this early musical training has really helped me. I can follow a score. I can understand music, even though I don't play myself. I mean, my life is underscored anyway. I sort of feel music around me all the time. But particularly when you're telling stories, it does such an amazing job because it's so immediate. It's so emotional. And I'm not a great fan of lots of words in theatre. I like to only speak when necessary. And music can really help you set a scene, hit some cultural references that people understand, give the actors some support so that they can do as little, as marvellously little as possible on top.
The value of silence too.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of my shows are very underscored and composed, but there will always be a moment when the music stops.
Did you learn much at the Guildhall Drama School in London where you went next?
Possibly not. That sounds much ruder than I want it to be. I was very young. I was very afraid. And I don't think I was very good. Mm. And when I say I think I was a perfectly good and possibly interesting performer, but I don't think I was ever a good actor. So therefore, if you had put all those things together, it was a little bit like my secondary school experience. I worked incredibly hard. I was very diligent. I loved it. But I felt I couldn't find myself there. And theatre's such an odd thing to do. It's very odd, isn't it, to imagine being somebody else and to become a vessel for somebody else. It's a sort of profound act of empathy, which when you're very young is quite tricky. And it turns out that my empathy valve is much better placed as a director and writer than it ever was as a performer.
Quite often people at that age are finding it difficult to realise themselves, let alone anybody else.
Well, absolutely. Life is so complicated and tricky at that point. And this was in the 80s. It was scary and lonely.
Did things get better in Exeter when you joined the theatre group there?
Yes. I eventually got a job with a company in Exeter called Theatre Alibi who told stories to children in primary schools. And I have to say, it was a rather heavy heart that I got on the train to Exeter because it wasn't... I was dreaming of the RSC and of the National Theatre. But they changed my life. All the people that ran Theatre Alibi had been to university, Exeter University, and were inspired by world theatre. And my mind was really open to different sorts of theatre. But also telling stories to children. It really has been the guiding light of my process. Children tell you what they want to happen next. They tell you what's boring. They tell you what's funny. They are completely honest. And really those techniques of speaking very honestly to younger people and learning what they need and listening to their responses, I use every day of my professional life.
It was an early start, wasn't it? Literally.
Literally. 5 o'clock in the morning we would get up, get in the van. But you know what was interesting? You know, I wouldn't trade those years for anything because that was really my training. We would put up the set, we would tell one set of stories to one set of children. The dinner ladies would shoo us away. We'd tell another set of stories in the afternoon. We'd get in the van and we would drive home and discuss everything. We would chat about what we saw, what happened, what we could improve. And I really found a work ethic and a belief in what I was doing there, which I hadn't found at drama school.
And you also spent some time in Poland after yes. that. It's always good at that age, isn't it, to open your eyes to another culture?
That's one way of putting it. It absolutely opened my eyes. It was absolutely terrifying. I'm so proud of myself from where I am now that I did it. I met Gardzianice Theatre Association through Theatre Alibi. We had a grant to train with them. They asked me to return as a performer, which I did. I never knew whether I was getting paid. We used to meet at dusk and work until it was decreed that we could go home. So we'd work through the night. So sometimes you'd work till 5 o'clock in the morning, pushing through exhaustion. We'd run through the forests. It was absolutely life-changing and also very brutal.
What do you think you took away from that?
The absolute knowledge that only do theatre if it matters. And if it doesn't matter, please do something else. The sacrifices these people had made to be artists was so palpable that I felt the need to honour that. I also learned what I didn't want in my life. I hope I'm not misquoting, but there was definitely talk that there was no beauty without pain. And I can remember thinking, I know that isn't true. And I would really love my life to be filled with joy. And I think I do carry a lot of secret melancholy with me, but I also inherited a lot of joy. And I knew that I was never going to thrive long term in an environment that didn't value that.
Tchaikovsky next. And this is a composer who certainly knew the romantic ups and downs of life and managed to put them into his music.
Well, this isn't a very joyful piece. This is a very passionate and important piece to me. At Theatre Alibi, I met a young writer and performer called Dan Jameson, and we went on to get married. That marriage didn't last, but the impact on both of us has lasted. And we started thinking about making work together, and Dan wrote a play for us based on the artist Marc Chagall and his wife and writer Bella Chagall. And we were so young and so excited and passionate about what theatre could be. And it was a play by two young people in love about two young people in love. And this was really the piece of music that went throughout that piece. The reason we chose it is Marc Chagall was working on a ballet to this music when they were in exile in America, and Bella helped with the costume. So they worked on a version of this. But we felt that this spoke to such a profound melancholy and survival and great passion. And it has such a special part in my heart.
The performers on this were known at the time as the Million Dollar Trio because the pianist was Arthur Rubinstein, the cellist Gregor Piatigorsky, and the violinist none other than Jascha Heifetz. Pretty remarkable.
Pretty remarkable. And I don't know their stories, but I can only imagine, I think this was recorded in 1950, what they had gone through in the war. And I feel you can feel that raw passion coming through this recording.
Thank you. Music from Tchaikovsky's Piano Trio, performed by Artur Rubinstein, Gregor Piatigorsky, playing cello, and Yasha Heifetz, the violin.
Well, it's exquisite. I mean, I think that's the definition of soul music.
You're listening to Private Passions with my guest today, the director, Emma Rice. What was it that made you apply to the theatre company Nihai in 1994, Emma?
Well, everybody kept telling me. I was working in Exeter and there wasn't enough work full-time, you know, and I was hustling for a living, but knew I didn't really want to be freelance in London. I was already too unusual. And I just knew the second that I visited those barns on the clifftops in Cornwall and met these wild, funny, sexy, maverick, musical clowns, that these were the people that I wanted to spend the next years of my life with. And I did. They taught me to clown. They gave me the comedy and joy of my life. And I think I gave them some discipline. But I was very, very... I'm trying not to use the word bossy, because you would never say it about a man. So that's my pause. But I was bossy. And I would be calling rehearsals for shows that somebody else had directed to make it better. I was choreographing. I was really getting involved. And Mike Shepherd and Bill Mitchell, who ran the company at that time, said, Emma, you should direct. And I remember saying, no, I'm fine. I'll keep acting, but I'll just keep, you know, chipping in from the sides. And they said, seriously, Emma, we think you can do this. So I was absolutely encouraged and supported by them. And the first show, which I don't talk about much, and it wasn't recorded. I have no idea what this show was like.
Was that The Itch?
The Itch. I did a very cut-down version of the Jacobean tragedy, The Changeling. I played Beatrice Joanna. They had a cast of five, and there was lots of sort of running round the Cornish clifftops.
Well, the next music reminds you, I think, of that period in your life.
It was in the production of The Itch. We didn't have live music at that point. We didn't have enough money, so it was all soundtrack. I worked with my friend and composer, Stu Barker, to put together an incredible soundtrack. And again, we were working... This was an open-air show, so we would be on car parks, clifftops, beaches, performing this in the wild air. And this is the piece that I take away from it. There's a wonkiness to this incredible piece of music and a euphoria. And for me, that was when the person that I now know I am was beginning to emerge, wonky and euphoric.
Thank you. John Tavener became very interested in the spirituality and the music of other cultures, and you can really hear it there, almost bent notes in the opening.
It's what I love about it. I mean, it's a very emotional experience listening to it. He hits parts of the soul that you have been asleep for a very, very long time, and it is those bent, wonky, strange notes that feel so profoundly human to me. You know, and that spirituality, I think back to that time at Knee-High, and it was a wildly spiritual place. You know, we were partying hard, dreaming hard, we were working hard, but we were with the land.
We heard music from John Tavener's The Protecting Veil, The Annunciation, performed by Matthew Barley, and Sinfonietta Riga. How did you come to choose The Red Shoes as your next directorial work?
So this was really, really a turning point in my life that I still refer back to this day. I'd done The Itch, and Bill and Mike said to me, well, what are you going to direct now? And I hadn't thought about it. I was so unambitious at that point. And I said I hadn't thought. And they said, well, what would it be if it was going to be another show? And I said, The Red Shoes. And they said, great, let's do it. And I promise you, at that moment, I'd never seen the film, and I had no recollection of ever having heard the story. That story came to me in that moment of truth. The first thing I did was I watched the film and I thought, what have you done? There's this massive orchestra, Powell and Pressburger, opulence. And of course, we were a tiny company in Cornwall with no budget. So I was like, what have I done? This is a disaster. So I went to the Hans Christian Andersen and I read it in Exeter Library and I wept. I wept because this tiny three-page story spoke more to me about my life, my struggles, my sorrows than any naturalistic prose could do. And it really, you know, that story, The Red Shoes, talks about a life filled with passion and the cost of that passion and the addictive nature of that passion and how to control it. You need to chop off bits of yourself. And I was in the wake of my divorce at that time and couldn't really understand myself and couldn't forgive myself. And I created this story with such a raw affinity to the material and such a belief that whatever life threw at me, I would survive. I would be changed, but I would survive. And the show was a raw act of instinctive truth from all of our parts, every actor that made that show. And it lasted for many, many, many years. It was so powerful. My psyche, my soul tapped me on the shoulder and said, this is what you need to explore.
And this music was quite instrumental, wasn't it?
Well, I wanted to find all the music that was irresistible, that made you need to dance, that was beyond wanting to dance, that made you need to dance. And this goes back to me and Becca putting on costumes in our living rooms. We used to dance to great, passionate ballet tracks. And I chose this because it has a dark underbelly, a gravitational pull of sorrow, but also the absolute need and compulsion to move, and speaks to me of the red shoes and of my own red shoes, which I wear to this day.
Well, that had you hopping around the studio.
Turn up the volume and dance.
That was The Waltz from the Masquerade Suite by Aram Khachaturian, performed by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, conducted by Naima Yerby. Emma, one of the shows Nee Hai brought to the London stage was an adaptation of the film A Matter of Life and Death, performed at the National Theatre. Tell us a little bit about it.
Oh, well, it's an adaptation of the amazing Paul and Pressburger film, the film I had seen, unlike The Red Shoes. And I think I'd been spotted by Nick Heitner at the National, and we'd been very separate from the rest of the industry. You know, we were very unaltered. We weren't aware of what anybody else was doing. We didn't care what anybody else was doing. So I think there was probably a real excitement about Nee Hai's immediacy and unique quality. And it was on a huge scale. It was on the Olivier stage, which I've never performed since. Massive cast. And I wasn't scared at all because I'd created work on cliff tops. Why would a theatre scare me? I had smoking nurses on bicycles. I had hospital beds bursting into flames. Then the hospital beds winched into the ceiling to create a stairway that the hero walked up. I think it was probably magnificent. But it got absolutely panned in the press. Absolutely panned. To my absolute shock, I think I'd been so sheltered from the London world. You know, I didn't see it coming. The company was so happy and we loved the work so much that it was absolutely flooring to suddenly get these terrible reviews. And then my memory is that marvellous Nick Heitner decided to sort of back me up. I think he was very frustrated that he was trying to bring fresh female voices to the National and the press were so critical. And he called them dead white men, which went down in history. And of course, all that did was that they got, no, we're not dead white men. We just don't like Emma Rice's work. I got a second go. But lots of the female critics did enjoy it. The Sundays came back. It's become quite an iconic show. And I had to grow up as an artist very, very, very fast.
You became co-artistic director of Nee Hai with Mike Shepherd. And actually, you were also a couple. Did that have challenges as well as joys?
Yes, but all relationships have challenges.
No, but I meant running something together.
Yes. We were a very good couple, Mike and I, in that we had very, very different skills. So there was things Mike absolutely would never do that I was happy to do and vice versa. But my work is so much part of my life. There is no line between my life and my work. So all my relationships have had to integrate with the work. And I would say overall, it's only joyful.
Would you say that you have to throw yourself 100% into whatever you're doing?
Yes. I wouldn't know how to do it otherwise.
Buena Vista Social Club next. They certainly know how to put everything into their work.
Oh, yes. You know, those years at Nee Hai were really, really magic. We were a family and we were a strange family. We were a complicated family. We all were falling in love with the wrong people and all the fallout of that. But, you know, we've welcomed children to the world. We've buried each other's parents. You know, we are a community which is unstoppable. And there would be nights when we would light a fire and play music and dance together, all in different couples. They remain some of the happiest times of my life. The sheer delightful, loving mess of it. And when this landed, we couldn't believe our luck.
Chan chan, en el mar se rían arena como si
Chan Chan, performed by Buena Vista Social Club. In 2016, you joined Shakespeare's Globe as artistic director. What was it like leaving Cornwall behind?
Well, it felt like time. I think I'd known for a while that this chapter was closing. And the Globe headhunted me, and there wouldn't be many jobs that I would consider, but of course Shakespeare was the ultimate storyteller, and also this small canon, which I liked. 37 amazing stories that demand to be retold again and again. And I thought, well, I love working outdoors. I love stories. I need a new adventure. And I got the job.
And the first production was A Midsummer Night's Dream?
Yes.
Somebody described it as disruptive, unnerving, highly comic, but that probably rather pleased you.
Yes, why would it not? Comedy is the absolute lifeblood of live performance, because if you can make people laugh, it's because they recognise something truthful, which means you will then make them cry. You open up the human spirit with laughter.
Did you enjoy your time at the Globe until things went wrong?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because they went wrong so very quickly. I loved that theatre. And I loved my staff and I loved the work I made there. So there was lots of good there. But what happened with the board was very brutal from my perspective and was another, I was going to say setback, but that is such a tiny way to describe something that in my life was so seismic. I thought I could read a room and I didn't. I thought if I did a good job, that would be enough, and it wasn't. And I never felt more like the comprehensive girl that I was. I never felt more of an imposter. And yet, I have a very healthy ego. So I was thinking, how can this work that I'm doing 99% business to screaming, joyful crowds, and yet I am not good enough to be in the boardroom? And I don't know whether I've ever squared that with myself.
Do you think you were up against Shakespeare purists, people who felt that this is the only way you should really do Shakespeare, and that to give actors microphones to put in a different sort of music, isn't innovation too far for them?
Well, I don't think it. I know it. I was up against Shakespeare purists. And of course, they're right in that everybody's right. You know, the arts are a magnificently Catholic world. You know, everything can exist. And in fact, even if we did have a sound system in the globe, you did not have to use it. And not every director did. But I feel like I'm arguing my case, which I don't need to do.
But there is an interesting point here, and I put it in terms of, let's just slightly change the context. You know, people get very upset when operas are done in a completely different way, sort of challenging way. And yet my feeling has always been that great works of art can take anything, and it's probably the only way of seeing what else comes out of them, going behind them and looking from a different vantage point.
I agree entirely. And I've always said that, you know, and I always say, well, if you don't like what I did with Brief Encounter, go and watch the original one. It is unchanged. And similarly with Shakespeare plays, they are so strong. You can do whatever you like to a Shakespeare play, and those amazing words will still exist for somebody else to do something with. And I certainly believe the Globe was strong enough to have my experiment live there happily, and then pass it on to the next person.
Well, it is opera that we go to now. And if there was ever a composer and a dramatist who sort of mirror each other in their ability to explore human foibles, I think it's Shakespeare and Mozart.
Oh, yes. Well, they're both gods, aren't they, of their understanding, their superhuman ability to understand the human existence and the foibles of it and the complexity of it and the silliness of it. Both of them have an unbelievable eye on the world.
What have you chosen?
The Prayer from Mozart's Don Giovanni. There was a brief period after my time in Poland where I became a choreographer, which is so laughable because I'm not a dancer. But I did choreograph Don Giovanni for Katie Mitchell at the Welsh National Opera, and it was the first time that I'd really absorbed myself in an opera. The music is absolutely beautiful, and I know it backwards because of that. And then while I was still at knee high, I decided to make a stage version of the story. I was very interested in all the fascination in a man who slept with 2,000 women. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting for a woman to look at that character and to think about all the women that he sleeps with rather than him? So I created a production for the RSC with Knee High called Don John, a British version set in the 1970s, my magical hinterland. I had a live band, I had dancers. It was really ahead of its time. But I really wanted to honour Mozart. I did put this prayer in, when the three characters are summoning up their spiritual courage to call out Don John. And it's the most exquisite bit of humanity because all the voices and emotions blend together. And this sat at the centre of my modern retelling.
And that's one of the extraordinary things about opera, which you don't quite have in the theatre, that people can voice different feelings simultaneously. Do you find that exciting?
Oh, absolutely thrilling. But I say you can do that in theatre, visually and with movement.
Well, here's how Mozart does it.
Thank you.
Protegga il giusto cielo, from Mozart's Don Giovanni, Act One. We heard the soprano Renée Fleming, the mezzo Anne Murray, and the tenor Herbert Lippert, with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by George Scholte. Emma, you set up your own production company called Wise Children in Frome in Somerset, named, I imagine, after Angela Carter's last novel.
Yes. I love Angela Carter. She's been a big part of my life. But this particular novel, I had been wanting to adapt for some time and had actually been trying to sell it to various places that didn't want it, and indeed was planning to put it on at the Globe because it mentions every Shakespeare play within its wonderful pages. It's set in London. It's set on either side of the Thames. And in the wake of what happened at the Globe, I just knew that this would be my first piece. It's about being on the wrong side of the tracks. It's about the love of popular storytelling, the bleeding feet of what it takes to be a hoofer, what it takes to keep being a touring minstrel, to keep getting up and entertaining people. So I called my company that. And I think in the wake of the Globe, I knew two things. I never wanted to find myself in that position again, so I needed to be smart. But I also didn't want to lose my childlike joy, so I wanted to be silly. And I felt like being a wise child absolutely encapsulated my challenge to myself as I went forward.
It's a piece from Brief Encounter Next, another famous film, which knee-high toured.
It was a very successful show. It went to Broadway briefly, so it was a big moment for me. But I also met my now partner on this. It was a messy start, as a lot of my relationships have been. So there was a bit of life imitating art, but we've now been together for many, many years, and I hope it will be my last grand passion. I overlaid this adaptation with the structure of a silky story, which is the story of a woman who is out of her environment, which I felt Laura in Brief Encounter was. And I've wove that theme of the sea and of her true self calling her. And in many ways, I am the seal woman as well. This is my true self. I've found her now. I'm very, very happy. I'm very at peace. But you cannot listen to this Rachmaninoff without thinking about all the hearts you've broken and your own broken heart and the fact that it is all worth it. So I know this isn't a dedication programme, but I do have to dedicate this one to Simon Baker.
Thank you.
It's almost too much for body and soul to bear. It's so beautiful.
The opening of Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2 in C minor, played by Christian Zimmermann with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Seiji Ozawa. Your most recent touring production, Emma Rice, is North by Northwest, another very famous film. What is it about these classic films that turn you on quite so much, do you think?
Well, they're just fantastically popular, aren't they? And I always say popular, I mean with me as well, is that we return to these films. They're so dashing. I mean, I tend to return to films of the 40s and 50s, a world that I live in quite a lot because that's what my parents talked about and my grandparents lived in. I think about that post-war time and how difficult it was and what my grandfather endured and what other men of that generation endured and what hope people post-war had. And North by Northwest is horribly relevant. At the heart of this romp, there's the United Nations, like a beacon, this shining, beautiful building saying we will work together as different nations in the pursuit of peace. And, you know, making it's been very moving and challenging. And just to think about what it is to live in a world where we're nearly forgetting about the horrors of war and conflict on these shores.
Wise Children also runs a training programme to nurture a new generation of theatre practitioners. Do you feel that the UK theatre scene is in a healthy place at the moment?
Oh, no. We're in a very tricky spot, particularly after COVID. It's hard to bounce back. And the cost of living crisis. If you put those two things together, where people lost the habit of going to theatres, a lot of the older generation have never come back. But at the same time, everything costs three times more. So you have less money and get less for your money. So it's really difficult. But nobody said it was going to be easy. Wise Children is like a little tugboat. You know, we're not like a tanker. We can change with the winds. We can be light on our feet. So we're doing OK.
Emma Rice, you're ending today's programme by giving us all an instruction. What is it and why?
It is. Chill out. Things are going to change. I love this piece of music. It threads together so many of the things we've talked about today. You know, my dad was a great jazz lover and blues lover. He'd be delighted that I chose a little bit of John Lee Hooker. And I just think, you know, if I've learned anything in this bumpy, chaotic life of mine, it's to embrace change. The one thing that is certain is things are going to change. So you might as well not worry about it. You have to embrace it. And this beautiful song, it's like the end of the night. Everybody's left the party. You're clearing up and you put this on and you think, yeah, it's going to be all right. And it largely is.
Emma Rice, thank you very much.
Thank you. I've loved it.
Change. Thing. for the home up the road, baby. They ain't gonna change, baby. Your time now, baby. But after a while, gonna be my time, baby. They ain't gonna change. They ain't gonna change.
Things Are Gonna Change, composed and performed by John Lee Hooker and Carlos Santana. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the theatre director Emma Rice. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael will be talking to the writer Philip Hoare.
Join us for a very special concert marking the 80th anniversary of VE Day. The BBC Concert Orchestra and the Central Band of the Royal Air Force play commemorative music alongside readings and first-hand accounts of entertaining troops in 1945. Join me, Petrock Trelawney, and squadron leader Amy Casey for Friday Night is Music Night. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Hello from me, John Shea. I'm here to keep you company throughout this afternoon and evening on Radio 3. Choral Evensong at 3 o'clock is a recording of last Wednesday's service from the Chapel of Jesus College, Cambridge. Alan Shipton is here after that at 4 with more of your jazz record requests. And then Hannah French presents the early music show at 5 o'clock. Now on BBC Radio 3, it's 1:30 and time for this week's edition of Music Map with Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we make musical connections across time, drawing on a wide variety of sounds that help us to locate a single piece of music with more context. And today, our destination is Scott Joplin's The Entertainer. This is the laid-back rag that, since it was made popular in the score to the film The Sting, has been instantly recognisable to modern ears. If you learned the piano when you were a kid, the chances are you played a simple version of it. It is the epitome of ragtime, which is the precursor to jazz. And as we journey towards this music on today's show, we'll be hearing lots of other rags and homages to the form from outside the jazz world. But let's start with one of the strong musical influences that seeped into what became the blossoming of ragtime in the 1900s, and that's the popular marches of the American composer John Philip Sousa.